The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight I thought I would share some Dharma poetry with you. There's one poem here in this text, the Majjhima Nikaya, middle-length discourses of the Buddha, that appears four times right in a row in this book. And that kind of got my attention, the fact that it appeared four times. And the kind of the way they unfold, there's two people talking, and they say something like, "Do you remember that poem?" "No, I don't remember that poem. Maybe we should ask somebody about it." And so they all begin that in that kind of way. "Do you remember that that poem?" And since it's repeated four times, I kind of get the idea. Maybe it's a good one to reflect on, to think about, to explore. So I'll read it to you. My understanding about the poetry, the verses that the Buddha spoke. He was apparently very skilled at poetry. So when he was speaking the poetry, it was like, you know, perfectly metered and had a lot of wordplay in it. Lines juxtaposed, where a line could be associated with the previous line or the next line. All of that subtlety gets lost, unfortunately, in the translation. So it's kind of sounds kind of like a pedantic kind of poem. So I can only just imagine it must have been different in the original version. But I'll read this to you. And then what I'd like to do is to talk about it, because I see this as a teaching poem. I kind of think of it almost as a poem that somebody might memorize and then use almost to inspire them when they go off to sit in meditation. "Let not a person revive the past or on the future build one's hopes. For the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let one see each presently arisen state. Let one know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come. Who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But for one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly by day, by night, it is that one, the peaceful sage has said, who has had a single excellent night." And the poem is called "A Single Excellent Night." So I'd like to look at this, kind of explore what this poem means, line by line. So the first line: "Let not a person revive the past." That's, you know, we all do this. We all revive the past. You know, thoughts arise in our mind, and we kind of live in that world for a period of time. You know, in the description of this, there's an exposition that's associated with the poem, and in the description of it, the description says that one revives the past by basically clinging to it, by craving it, by holding on to it, by having thoughts appear. "Oh, my past was this way. Oh, wasn't that wonderful?" Or, "Oh, wasn't that horrible?" You know, so some kind of a relationship with these thoughts that come up. It doesn't say that this sentence, "Let not a person revive the past," it doesn't mean or say that thoughts of the past never appear. But it's kind of an exploration of, or an understanding of, how are these thoughts? What is our relationship to these thoughts? What is our relationship to thoughts of the past when they come up? They are simply, as experiences, a thought of the past is simply something that's happening right now. That's a piece to kind of keep in mind. But they often, they have a very strong deluding quality. You know, we believe them. And we almost get born into that world of the past when these thoughts come up. This happens in different ways, I see, in my own experience. Sometimes thoughts of the past come up, and it's, wasn't that great? And, that was wonderful, and everything was beautiful, and, so we're kind of lost in the world of wanting to have that past. You know, we're essentially reviving the past so that we can re-feel the pleasantness of that experience, or have that experience as if it's happening again to us. Another way that we revive the past is by, thinking about all the horrible things that happened to us. This was my specialty. And just, oh, that happened. There's kind of a projecting back, almost trying to figure out how I could have done it differently. Over and over again, replaying something. Oh, if only I'd done that, if only I'd said that, if only I'd thought to do that in that moment. Just trying to somehow revise it. Thinking back on the past and, if only. And we're replaying it over and over again, somehow thinking that if I do it just right in my memory, it'll change how it happened.
My dad's a master of that.
It's a common pattern. I mean, it's something that many of us do, and we get caught, we get hooked by that. So often, when we're reviving the past like that, it has some emotional charge for us. It might have a charge of wow, that was great, or it might have a charge of that was awful. How can I redo the past? How can I fix that past so that it's not like this now? So there's often that kind of emotional tone to that quality of reviving the past. But I've also seen something that's a little different, and it's more of a just recognizing the deluding quality of how we get caught in our thoughts about the past. I'll tell you how I saw this in my own experience. There was I was in a relationship, and that relationship broke up in a very unpleasant way, and there was a lot of thoughts, memories that came up for years around that relationship, and a lot of this reviving the past, came up around it. It came up around what a horrible thing he had done to me. It came up around, oh, those beautiful experiences. Oh, never again. I'll never be happy again. And over time, working through all of those emotions around that breakup, it took several years. But I did get to the place where thoughts of my boyfriend could appear in my mind without there being emotional charge around them. And when that started to happen, I started to experience something new around this reviving the past business. What I saw was that I could be walking down the street, and then I would wake up into this thought bubble of being back in the relationship with him. And in the waking up, there was just this incredible confusion, because there wasn't... In the previous, before I had kind of worked through all the emotions, whenever I had woken up into a memory like that, there'd been despair, there'd been frustration, there'd been anger, there'd been all kinds of emotional reactivity. This time, with those emotions having subsided, when I woke up into that thought, I realized how completely deluded the mind had been in those thoughts. That it had believed, for the time I was in that thought world, it had completely believed that I was back there in that relationship. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm new to this this evening. Is this a discussion?
It can be. I'm happy to have it be a discussion. Yeah.
Well, current science has proven that when we remember and or dream, our brain does not know the difference. Since it's encased in our head, uh-huh. those thoughts of the past and or even dreams are proving, have got the body completely fooled. You can have that experience and watch your adrenaline go up, having this physical sensation of this mental reoccurrence.
That's right. And that can happen, but it doesn't have to happen.
No, it doesn't. Recognizing it is the biggest step.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And so that's kind of what I'm pointing to here. So there's this, you know, this incredible deluding nature, which is what I think science is pointing to, this deluding nature of our thoughts. They have us believe the experience. And, you know, in that kind of waking up into that thought bubble, I was walking with a friend, actually, and I said, wow, I just woke up into this, you know, it was like a dream. I was back with my boyfriend, and we were in relationship again. It's like, you know, here I am. There's nothing. There's no relationship. It was just had me completely fooled. And her response was, wow, that sounds painful. I said, no, it's not painful at all. It's just confusing. You know, it's just like, wow, where was I? You know, how the mind was just completely deluded. So this kind of deluding nature, this kind of delusion happens to us all the time when we get caught in our thoughts. So there's that side. There's the, you know, reviving the past. And there's a lot, you know, this is a lot of the way we construct some of our suffering, you know, we revive the past. If we're reviving the unpleasant past, which we do, I'm a specialist at that one, you know, that reviving the unpleasant past essentially brings up the unpleasant experience here and now. Sometimes we revive the pleasant past as a strategy because we don't like what's happening now. And that's an interesting thing to explore, you know, that something's happening now. I'm unhappy, I'm miserable, and, oh, well, you know, our mind as a strategy kind of goes back to a time when we were happy and puts us in that space so that we're feeling those feelings. But then when that bubble bursts, at least in my experience, when that bubble bursts, there's a sense almost of like, oh, that's not happening, you know? That's delusion. That's not happening, and here I am in this space now. So this getting caught up in the past in this way, you know, it takes us away from being here now. It takes us away from being able to live life here now. And it has this deluding quality to it. So look into your own experience and see how helpful is it for you when this kind of thing happens? You know, is it actually a helpful strategy or not? I think if you really explore it, if you really look at it in your own experience, you'll see that it's not so helpful, that it's not a very helpful strategy. You know, this revising the past business, never going to work. It doesn't work to try to do that. Then there's the exploring the, it says, or on the future build one's hopes. That's an interesting phraseology, I think, because I think this notion of, you know, projecting into the future, there's multiple ways I think this happens too. I mean, we project into the future fantasizing about what things may be like. You know, oh, it'll be so great if I get this or do that or get that job or buy that house or get that car. You know, we
win the lottery.
Win the lottery, yes. So it'll, you know, we project that into the future and kind of, you know, create a fantasy world in a sense. Another way we do this, though, you know, this notion of going into the future is with worry and anxiety. You know, that it's not just, we don't just do this projecting into the future and getting caught by the future when it's a pleasant kind of fantasy. We do it a lot with unpleasantness as well, with worry. What if that happens? What if that happens? What if that happens? Again, this was my specialty. I would think into the future and imagine all kinds of different scenarios about what might happen and figure out how I would respond if they did happen, come up with the perfect thing to say, the perfect way to act. It was a kind of a way of dealing with the fear of the unknown, you know, this projecting into the future around worry. It was a way to deal with the fear of the unknown and a way to sense like, I'm in control here, I can navigate my life. So there was something that it was kind of doing for me in a way. But, you know, it was a tremendous waste of time, because I would say of all of the futures I projected, well, and then there would be times too I would create a future and then get mad about it. It's like, well, that's going to happen. Oh, well, that that would be horrible, and oh, I'm so mad that person did that thing. Wait a minute, they didn't do that thing. I just imagined that they did that thing. So we create these kind of imagined futures. And in looking at that and exploring that in my own experience, you know, it's like, oh, well, what if that person did that? Well, how would I respond? When I actually began looking at my thoughts, I would say a good 90% of them, those imagined scenarios, never happened. And then the ones that did happen, you know, so maybe 10% of them, I was in the rough terrain of something that actually did unfold. Almost never could I respond in the way that I imagined I would be responding. Because conditions come together and you respond the way you're going to respond in the moment. And so, you know, I really began to see how much of a waste of time this practice of imagining futures was. Really, I think in this, you know, what I've come to in my own experience is that a kind of a trust that if I can meet this moment as fully and completely as I can, then that creates the conditions, it sets up the conditions for me to be able to meet whatever future comes in a more skillful way. So that the, you know, that this whole thing about projecting into the future, dealing, you know, the sense of needing to be in control or somehow anticipating all possible outcomes, that there's a fear around that for me. And when I began to realize that if I just meet this moment as best I can, then that it not only creates the conditions for me to be able to you know, to meet whatever happens more skillfully, it's cultivating these beautiful qualities. It cultivates mindfulness, it cultivates open-heartedness to whatever is happening, and those qualities are what allow us to meet our lives as they unfold. So for me, this has been a real beautiful way to explore navigating the future, navigating life. To not project into the future and live in that world. Now, we do have to think about the future. I mean, I'm not saying that thoughts of the future are inherently bad, because we need them. You know, there's no way to live without thinking about the future. But if you look at your thoughts of the future, I think you'll see that there's some percentage that are kind of practical, helping us get through our lives. But many, many of them have this quality of doing this, it's building hopes on the future, whether it's building hopes on something that we hope to happen or building hopes on something we hope won't happen. So to look at your experience and see, where is it useful for you to be thinking thoughts of the future? We don't have to stop thinking thoughts. I mean, we can't stop thinking thoughts. We need to think. So let not a person revive the past or on the future build one's hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. So as I said about, you know, thoughts of the past, they are simply something coming up in the present moment. It's an experience. It's an arising of a memory coming up in the present moment. So it's something that's happening now. The thought of the past is something that's happening now. Likewise, the thought of the future is also something happening now. It is just an experience coming up. It's less connected with actuality than thoughts of the past are. Thoughts of the past, often there's some kind of connection with something that actually happened. Thoughts of the future are complete, complete construction of the mind, complete fantasy. They fool us into thinking they're not. But there's no basis in reality for thoughts of the future. So there, again, something coming up in the present moment. A thought, it's arising in the present moment. So the next line points to this. Instead, with insight, let one see each presently arisen state. So this is the exploration around meeting the moment, meeting this moment here and now. What does it mean to meet that this moment with insight? It's kind of a big topic, and I'm going to just try to talk about it kind of in broad brushstrokes right now. And then I'd like to open up for a little bit more back and forth discussion. There's different kinds of insights. There are kind of insights that have to do with our own personal history, you know, why we are the way we are. They're personal insights. Maybe call them psychological insights. And psychological insights, I think, have kind of multiple layers to them. There can be psychological insights where we recognize by thinking about something, we recognize, yeah, okay, that kind of explains why I am the way I am. You know, that relationship is related to why this pattern is coming up for me. That may be at the level of kind of reflection, thinking about that kind of insight, a kind of a connection of ideas. So I think I'm going to tell a story about this from my practice to make these different kinds of insights I'm going to talk about tangible for you. In my experience, I had a strong pattern around self-hatred. And I did some therapy around this. And through that therapy came to an understanding of that it was connected with a particular relationship. And, it kind of made sense to me. I mean, there was kind of that intellectual, there was kind of an aha about that. But, you know, it didn't do much to that pattern of self-hatred. And, you know, it wasn't actually a very deep kind of psychological insight. It was just kind of reflecting on ideas. And then on one retreat, I kind of had a clear recognition of how the that relationship was related to that pattern. It happened in a moment where I kind of realized, oh, I see, there is a connection. It was a felt understanding of the connection between that relationship and this pattern of self-hatred. I don't actually recall what I saw in that moment, but I can imagine it being something along the lines of a memory from my past arising in the present moment and seeing how the self-hatred was connected to that memory. So kind of, you know, seeing in this moment, this is how, you know, this is in a way exploring the present and the benefit that can come from that. So there was a kind of a psychological recognition of, yes, this explanation that my therapist had come up with and that I had kind of said, yeah, that makes sense. There was a deep feeling of truth and of resonance that happened there. And there was an opening of the heart that happened. There was a feeling of compassion that arose for myself, for the other person, and a sense of, oh, wow, you know, it really felt, there was a real opening of the heart. That also I would call a psychological insight, because it was really about the personal history. You know, it's kind of this pattern in my life, this pattern around self-hatred. How did it come to be? What were the conditions that led to this in my life? So there was that's a kind of a psychological insight in a way. It came through this willingness to be present in the moment, willingness to meet the moment. To my surprise, because that feeling around that psychological insight was so deep and so powerful, I kind of thought that I had gotten to the bottom of the self-hatred. It did not touch the pattern of self-hatred. It kept coming back just as strong. There was a difference, however, that happened in my experience, and that was that because of having clearly seen the causes and conditions that led to that pattern, it was easier to be with the feeling of self-hatred without being threatened by it. It's kind of like, of course this is the way things are. This was my past. These were the conditions. So understanding how the conditioned nature of that pattern did have an impact. I mean, it didn't prevent it from coming up, and it didn't prevent it from feeling any better. I mean, it didn't make me feel any better when it came up. It felt just as awful to have that feeling of self-hatred come up. But it did make it easier for me to meet it with mindfulness, to meet that presently arisen state of self-hatred in the moment. So this is kind of a trajectory of different kinds of insights I'm talking about. So by having that kind of psychological insight around that difficult pattern, making it easier for me to just meet, this is self-hatred arising. This is the experience of self-hatred. This is what's happening right now. In exploring that feeling of self-hatred coming up over and over again, because it was up for me on this one retreat. This was a 3-month retreat. It was a long retreat, and it kept coming up. So it was a strong repeating pattern. And so I got to watch it a lot on that retreat. And at one point, in seeing it come up in the moment, presently arising, just actually seeing it come up from the very roots, I recognized this is just a thought. This is just a thought. That I would call what we could call a meditative insight, because I was seeing the ephemeral nature of the thought, and how that ephemeral nothing of a thought was connected to creating a pattern in my mind, seeing the kind of impermanent and ephemeral nature of experience. That experience had a very deep impact on that pattern of self-hatred. I didn't actually trust it. I mean, there was a moment after that insight happened, it's like, oh, there was bliss in the mind. It was like, I went from self-hatred to bliss in a split second. Oh. And then there was this little thought in my mind, never again. and I saw that thought, and it's like, no, you know, this was a condition that happened in this moment. I saw in this moment the truth of that was just a thought. And the pattern may come back, you know. So there was a kind of a recognition around the impermanence of the insight itself. You know, that when we have deep insights, the kind of conditions come together for us to be able to see something really clearly in one moment. And then an hour later, it's like, what was that? What did I see? Did I really see that? So, you know, so the conditions come together around insight and allow us to see something, but the conditions are not always there. But with this kind of a deeper insight, there does seem to be a shift that happens in the mind. You know, a shift around having seen something really clearly, like the impermanent nature of a thought around a pattern. It's like, my experience actually around that particular pattern was that it was a long time before I noticed thoughts of self-hatred again. So the pattern had really shifted dramatically by that one moment of insight. And then after years, several years, I began seeing, no, there's still thoughts there. You're no good, you're a failure, you're bad, I saw those thoughts, but what had been cut was the belief for those thoughts. So, you know, this kind of deeper insight can kind of alter the structure of our minds. It can shift our the core beliefs that are under our kind of sitting underneath our experience, the arising of our experience. So the insights that really have this power to free us, psychological insights are helpful. They are helpful. I've seen that in my own experience, that they are helpful. But they don't necessarily free us from the pattern. They don't necessarily free us from the conditioning. The insights into impermanence, into the unreliability of experience, that, you know, there's nothing in our experience that's going to be reliable for, you know, we tend to think that there's something going to do it for us. You know, maybe it's reviving the past. Yeah, that was that, you know, we believe it in that moment. It deludes us into thinking in that moment, yes, this is making me happy. But then we wake up and we realize, oh, well, that's not very satisfying. But because we've had a moment of feeling kind of happy in that state, it's like we're just pulled back. It's like that's the only way we know how to be happy. We know there's certain strategies that we all have around finding happiness, you know, reviving the past or having fantasies about the future or accumulating things, having people admire us. We all have our own strategies, and we find in living our lives that these are not very reliable strategies. Gives us some moments of happiness. It gives us some time of, oh, feeling like we figured it out. But that passes. And then we feel like we're back on this kind of hamster wheel of, I've got to figure out the next thing to get or have or create or construct so that I can have that moment of happiness again. And we seem to think that happiness comes from linking together as many of those moments as we can. The insights into impermanence, unreliability, and essentially ephemerality of not self, I'll talk about that one in just a minute, these really free us from that deluded belief around where happiness is found. And we begin to touch into a deeper kind of happiness that comes from letting go of trying to endlessly construct our experience to be what we think we want it to be. And in that letting go, there's a deep kind of peace, a very deep kind of peace that is not dependent on having anything or getting rid of anything, but is just here in this moment, by the ability to meet each presently arisen state with insight. So this third insight around not self, I'll just say a few words about this. Often it is, it's hard to grok. It's like, it feels like I'm a self, right? It's kind of hard to, shift the mind to say, well, So there's a strong kind of feeling of there being someone here. The understanding around not self isn't so much that there isn't something here, but it is that we misunderstand our experience to construct something that's kind of solid and durable, kind of a solid sense of this is me, thinking that this me travels, this entity is always the same and it travels through time. The understanding around not self is that not that there's not something here. There's a process here. There's a flow of experience here. There's not an entity that's traveling through time, but there is a process that is unfolding in time. So thinking of a tree, a tree grows. If you've got a seed, the seed gets planted, it gets watered, conditions come together, perhaps for that seed to sprout. It may get to live a little bit longer if there aren't any lawnmowers or animals around to cut it down. Conditions may come together for it to grow more. So there are conditions that come together to create that process of a tree. It's not an entity. It fools us into thinking of it as an entity because it looks so stable. But it is, it was a seed at one point, and then it became this sprout, and it grew roots, and it produced leaves. It's a process, like we are a process. So this is a kind of a shift of understanding around ourselves. And a lot of our suffering, this reviving the past, pinning our hopes on the future, is rooted in this kind of mistaken belief that there is someone here that has to find or create some kind of stable happiness in their lives. And that if we were willing to really explore ourselves as a flow, as a process, there's much less need to defend or protect anything. There's not much really to defend or protect. There's just this process, this changing process. So I'll leave it there for now. And then this last piece I'll just say about this last half of the poem. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come. Who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. This is really pointing to the fact that our own impermanence, that I was talking about the impermanence of experience, but our own impermanence, reflecting on our own impermanence, our own mortality, is very powerful. We don't often really take that in, it's all around us, the possibility that we can die like that. I was walking down the street today, and I was thinking about this talk, so I was kind of in the world of my thoughts and was walking, along the sidewalk and didn't hear, I don't know whether it was an electric car, it might have been because it was very quiet, a car backing up. And I was about 2 feet from that car as it was backing up. I don't think the person saw me. They got into my field of vision, and I sped up so that I, you know, wasn't hit. But, you know, if I'd been a little bit more into my thoughts or a little bit slower walking, I would have been under that car. You know, I probably wouldn't be sitting here tonight. So, you know, we do not know. We do not know when death will come. And this reflection is really powerful, actually. It doesn't have to be a depressing thing. You know, it doesn't have to be something that we, you know, think, oh, I might die at any time. It can actually inspire us to be the best person that we can be. To, you know, what are your priorities? You know, if you really took in the fact that you might die tomorrow, or going home on the freeway tonight, if you really took that in, how would you be? You know, the Buddha points to this exploration as being a motivator for us to really shift our priorities around what is most important to us. And finding a truer kind of happiness, a happiness that doesn't depend on having or getting, but on, you know, rather on letting go of needing things to be other than they are. This deeper kind of happiness is very worthwhile, worth cultivating. So, any thoughts, questions, comments, ideas, anything? The floor is yours. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, Victor's got one. Oh.
No, I'm curious on the transition between, and I think we all go through it, that's involved in the practice, of content-based introspection to less and less content. What I mean by content is your own stuff.
Yes, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Psychological stuff that you at first sort of mull around, and that's sort of the sandbox you play in. And then at some point it transitions to the less personal, and you see that as just a process.
Yes.
What, I'm sort of interested in sort of the pedagogic aspect, what is it that transitions in the individual that allows them to step outside of themselves a little bit to then see that process? Is it different for everybody? I know what it was for me. But.
I think there may be different things for different people, but I think part of it, I mean, what he's talking about really is the, you know, that when we're first exploring our minds, we're exploring our inner landscape, a lot of what we're exploring is the, you know, the content, or not even just the content, but just like there's a lot of emotional and there's a lot of terrain that we explore in this territory of psychological work. You know, that my self-hatred, or, you know, people explore so many different things that, you know, that their conditioning has led them to have these patterns come up so frequently. And they're often really connected with a lot of thinking. The first shift that we see, I think, is that that it's, we hear, you know, maybe it would be helpful for you to let go of your thoughts and just be with the feelings. That's kind of the first shift around this exploration. You know, that we see how caught we are by our thoughts, and we start to see this, you know, these worlds that get created, and how we're just not here when we're in our thoughts. And we start to see that, well, okay, so when I'm really lost in my thoughts, it's really hard to be present. And so we start to learn and begin to appreciate the value of letting go of the being caught in thought in favor of being with the feeling. Now, this is a transition. This transition can be a little bit uncomfortable at first, because we let go of our thoughts, and our thoughts are our strategies, right? I mean, our thoughts are our strategies of how we're trying to avoid these feelings. And so, if we let go of our thoughts, we let go of that strategy, it puts us right in the middle of our feelings. It's like, why do I want to do this? What good does this do me? And initially, we kind of have to take it a little bit on faith, in a way, that that's a helpful transition to make. And, in my own exploration of it, it didn't take very long before I could see, this is helpful. I'm suffering less by turning towards these feelings. So that's one transition. And it's, the transition happens partly because we hear something. We hear somebody say, this worked for me. That's what I read this book. They said, this worked for me. It's like, okay, I don't see how that's going to work. Pay attention to my anger. What good's that going to do? But it's like, okay, I'll see. I'll give it a try. And within a few weeks, I began seeing the benefits of that. I began recognizing that when I turned to that anger, I didn't get, it was like there's a feedback loop between thoughts and emotions. And if we stop being in the thoughts, it cuts that feedback loop. And the emotion has a chance to kind of live its life. It has a wave-like nature. It arises and it passes. So you begin to see, these emotions come and they go. They come and they go. So that first transition, we begin to recognize, okay, this is actually helpful. This is helping me to live my life more in a more easeful way when I actually turned to watch the emotions and let go of the thoughts. And then for a while we're willing, we're watching the emotions. That's kind of the terrain that we're in exploring the emotions. And often there's a little bit of an agenda there of we're exploring these emotions in order to get rid of them. And, it's kind of like there's a trajectory in our practice. That agenda to watch the emotions, having a little bit of an agenda to get rid of them, initially it's helpful in a way. I mean, it's encouraging us to investigate and explore our emotions. But over time we start to see that agenda actually is getting in our way. That agenda to get rid of the emotions is actually kind of locking them into place in a way. So we start to, over time, as we get more familiar with being present for our actual experience, we also, I think the trajectory here gives us the tools that have us be present for longer stretches of time. So we start to be able to be mindful more continuously. And as that happens, we more naturally start to see the processes as they unfold. So for myself, I began to be able to see a thought's arising. That thought is triggering or leading me in the direction of an emotion. So this is starting to look at the process of the experience. It's not so involved with what's coming up, but it's more, there's a thought, there's a reaction to that thought. This is what happens as a result of it. And we get just interested in how the process unfolds. So I think that second shift happens. It kind of grows organically out of the first shift because we're more willing to just be here with our feelings. And then, as we're more willing to be here, we cultivate the quality of mindfulness. It gets stronger and it kind of begins to reveal to us that things are just a process. So does that speak to you? What was it for you?
Well,
initially looking at the thinking process and seeing the content of the thoughts and how repetitive they were, and just being curious about, okay, why am I repeating these thoughts and these sort of fantasies? And I noticed in order to make myself feel better, I would go into story. And I would notice at some point, I noticed a correlation between thoughts going, when it would trigger, and when I would go into story. And I just started looking at that, and it was just an interesting phenomena.
Uh-huh.
And there was and I recognized that, well, I'm just constructing this.
Right.
So I started just being suspicious of the thought, all my thought processes. If I'm doing this, and I'm just sort of like, I had no idea. My mind was churning all the time. And if I had this going on, what else is going on? So I just sort of put a full stop on this, believing anything I thought for
uh-huh,
a while.
Uh-huh.
And that coupled with just meditating, that allowed more of a separation or less of a automated response to, it lowered the reactivity to things and created the separation between.
Right. Things. And that separation is a key piece too,
yeah.
That, you know, that happens with the practice, with the mindfulness. Yeah.
And just kind of unfolds from there.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks. Yeah. Tall.
This is something I've noticed in myself is this like anger or frustration that can come with the process of disillusionment, with noticing like the pattern of that thing that, you know, for example, that people are looking for, that next thing.
Yeah.
And then almost to this then this anger when I'm seeing this. And I've had these big kind of shifts. Like at some point I noticed, like became very attuned to this kind of quality of aliveness or inspiration. Then I started noticing how, you know, relating with these various people and they weren't feeling very alive or inspired. And it was just a brief period, but I was really, really sensitive to it. And it was really quite upsetting.
Mm-hmm. So partly I think you're touching on, tell me if this is what you're touching on, that as we kind of move into this terrain of these insights around impermanence, unreliability, not self, it's kind of like the mind goes, does it have to be that way? You know, it's almost like, you know, there's a rebelling against the truth in a way.
For me, it's more of an outward turned anger, which to me points to something in myself.
Uh-huh.
It's almost just like, what are you doing?
Ah, I see. Okay. So you're talking in relationship in a way.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Like I'll have to sit at this experience of work, like, what are you doing? What are we all doing here?
Uh-huh.
Why are you doing that? Like, or this tension with, like, I have this discomfort with my parents where I see like they're like, you know, really trying to kind of control the future in relationship to money, which is something for me that, yeah, I feel tension around. Or I was talking with a friend today and he's talking about, they're like, right now for me, it's all about, you know, have this kind of pleasant experience and just kind of have that again and again. And I'm like, I get it. There's this resistance for me that comes with, it's like I see the pattern and then let it go. But for some reason, there's a tension with the world,
mm-hmm,
that around that.
So is the tension around, we need to stop, so I don't want to keep everybody. We could talk. We could talk afterwards.
Okay.
It's 9:01 already, so I don't want to keep you past. So thank you for your attention and your questions.